Good afternoon, America. Welcome to Mark Levine's Inside Scoop, where we bring you all the news from Boston this week that the government does not want you to know. Yes, this week is the Democratic National Convention, and if you're a political junkie like me, you can't tear your eyes away from it. But whether you heard it or not, we're going to be replaying the highlights of the convention today and all this week, and also my commentary and yours. Because I want to hear what you think about these speeches. I've been particularly impressed because I've heard people speak to my mind, to my heart, to all the things, frankly, that I've been thinking and feeling and saying that I haven't heard too many other people say until now. You know, when I joined the Radio Wilderness a little over a year ago, there was virtually no one on the air saying these things. This was pre-Howard Dean. This was at a time when everyone was supporting the Bush war in Iraq. Everyone believed there were weapons of mass destruction. And only I was bringing out, it seemed, evidence that maybe the administration did not have all the facts. Maybe it was manipulating intelligence. Well, last night, the night before, to me what I heard was, it was great because it was beyond policies. It was beyond, okay, Democrats can bring health care and we can provide international assistance in Iraq and we can provide education to children and a chance to go to college and civil rights. It was beyond policy. It was a discussion of values. It was a discussion of democratic values and even more than that, a discussion of American values. And I got to tell you, it was very, very powerful. And so I want to go through each of the speeches that we heard. We didn't get a chance to discuss Bill Clinton yesterday, so I want to start with him. He, of course, gave his speech Monday night, but yesterday was Election Tuesday, and I was so busy debating with Republican Tom Robbins that we didn't even get a chance to get to his speech. And if you heard yesterday's show, and if you didn't, check out the archive at www.radioinsidescoop.com. If you heard yesterday's show, I think it was a typical example of, and this is a very friendly guy, Tom Robbins. I mean, he's a nice guy. I don't think he tries to, you know, shout me down or anything like that. But it shows you how the Republicans are really devoid of ideas. Every time I would bring something in a speech brought up by Jimmy Carter or Al Gore or Hillary Clinton, and I'd say, what do you think about this? You'll see, if you listen to the archive, he changed the subject. He went and he attacked the Democrats because they are trying this election to divide us. They are trying to attack us. And what I really appreciate about the convention was the high road, was the discussion of American values. And no one did that better. No one did that better last night than the up-and-coming speaker, the up-and-coming senator from Illinois, Barack Obama. If you missed that speech, go to cspan.org, hear it in full. We're going to be playing a lot of it tonight, today I should say, the highlights of it. But that was a very powerful speech, and it really spoke to my heart, and I think the heart of many Democrats. But let's start with Bill Clinton. And if you want to join in, please do. This is not a monologue. All you have to do is call in 877-57-SCOOP, toll free 877-57-SCOOP. And I particularly want to encourage you because, look, we have all the time in the world. If we don't get to Teresa Hines Carey today, we'll talk about her tomorrow, along with John Edwards' speech. The important thing is this is not a show of sound bites. It never has been. This is a show where we fully discuss these things. And so if you want to talk about Clinton's speech, Bill Clinton's speech, or Barack Obama's speech, or Teresa Hines Carey's speech, or you want to talk about some of the smaller speeches, Howard Dean, Ted Kennedy, Ron Reagan, please feel free, call in 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP, or you can send an email to comment@radioinsidescoop.com, or the last option, and the one that I know many of you like to do, is to comment on the blog at www.radioinsidescoop.com. So let's start off, and let's bring back the era of Bill Clinton. And I have to start with the song, because every time I hear this song, it brings chills up my spine. It's a reminder of the hope and the optimism that I felt way back in 1992 when we first elected the greatest president of my lifetime. So it begins with an introduction by Hillary Clinton.
Please welcome the 42nd President of the United States, Bill Clinton!
Now, when you hear that song, I mean, does it send chills up your spine, too? Does it remind you? It's Bill Clinton's song forever. And don't stop thinking about tomorrow. I mean, what a wonderful song. I got to tell you, if I worked for the Kerry campaign, he's got to have a theme song. You got to give the man a theme song. I hope he gets one. And I don't know there's anyone as inspiring as that. Don't stop thinking about tomorrow. Yesterday's gone. New life, new promise. Does it send chills up your spine, too? To me, every time I hear it, it almost brings tears to my eyes. Caller, you're on the air with Mark Levine. Does that song bring chills to your spine?
It certainly does. This is Ed from New York.
Hi, Ed from New York.
And I want to tell you that I thought Bill Clinton's speech was one of the best ones he ever gave. I mean, I remember listening to him when he was president, and he would go on and on. But this speech had punch. It had power, and when he said he talked about the draft dodging, or I don't want to call it draft dodging, but the George Bush and Dick Cheney and Bill Clinton didn't go to Vietnam, but John Kerry did. I thought he said it nicely, succinctly, and he got his message across. I thought he was a great speaker, and I thought Hillary's introduction of him was just as good.
Well, Ed, we're going to get to his speech. I have to tell you, I didn't think Hillary was as good as I've heard her be before. Maybe I'm being too difficult. I thought it was a fine speech. But we're going to be playing a lot of Bill Clinton's speech, and we're going to get to some of the very specifics that you mentioned, including that area that you mentioned. So let me go on. Let me play some snippets from the Clinton speech. And again, if you want to call in and comment, it's 877-57-SCOOP. So hang on, Ed. We're going to play some of Bill Clinton's speech. Let me just say that before I get to the first snippet, one of the things that Bill Clinton started with was saying that this year he wanted to make sure all the votes were counted, very important, and that we should run a positive campaign, that it's not about who is a good person, and I think that's right. It's a question of the fundamental differences in our ideas, who the Democrats stand for, who the Republicans stand for. Let's hear from Bill Clinton.
Democrats and Republicans have very different and deeply felt ideas about what choices we should make. They're rooted in fundamentally different views of how we should meet our common challenges at home and how we should play our role in the world. We Democrats want to build a world and an America of shared responsibilities and shared benefits. We want a world with more global cooperation, where we act alone only when we absolutely have to. We think the role of government should be to give people the tools and to create the conditions to make the most of their own lives, and we think everybody should have that chance. On the other hand, the Republicans in Washington believe that America should be run by the right people, their people. In a world in which America acts unilaterally when we can and cooperates when we have to, they believe the role of government is to concentrate wealth and power in the hands of those who embrace their economic, political, and social views, leaving ordinary citizens to fend for themselves on important matters like health care and retirement security. Now, since most Americans aren't that far to the right, our friends have to portray us Democrats as simply unacceptable, lacking in strength and values. In other words, they need a divided America. But we don't.
Now, to me, that was a very important line. I mean, they need a divided America, but we don't. And if you look at it, you look at the difference in the campaigns, you can see that John Kerry's run a very positive campaign. He's talking about who John Kerry is. And George Bush is running a very negative campaign, trying to attack John Kerry as a flip-flopper. And you heard it on Election Tuesday. If you heard the show yesterday, that's exactly what Tom Robbins was trying to do, trying to attack John Kerry. And what's interesting is every time I turn the conversation around to George Bush and his policies, what did Tom Robbins do? He went and he attacked John Kerry. What you'll find is the Republicans have actually given up the argument. They cannot defend this president. They know he's led us to the worst economic times since Herbert Hoover and taken us into a war based on lies that we didn't need to get into. And so they can't defend him. So what are they doing? They're seeking to attack, and they're seeking to divide us. And I thought Bill Clinton was excellent in this, and this is actually something he said earlier on when he was talking about his book, and we played that about a month ago. That Democrats believe that we should seek international support for what we do, that it's important how America is viewed in the world. You'll be hearing a lot of this, by the way, throughout the convention. But that if we have to go alone, we will, as Bill Clinton led the way, frankly, in the stopping the genocide in Kosovo. But Republicans believe that we should go alone and seek international support only if we have to. The Democrats care about equal opportunity for everyone, and Republicans care about putting the right people in power. This is very much Edwards' Two Americas themes, talking about the difference between a party that cares about the common person, the regular guy, and a party that cares about those that already have wealth and power. So I thought it was a very powerful point. And then Bill Clinton went on to talk about America after September 11th and how we really did have a unique opportunity on September 11th to bring this country together. He also brought this up, by the way, in speeches on his book as well. But I remember, I think you remember, September 11th, right? We all did come together as a nation. It didn't matter who was president. We were angry and upset and shocked and caring for our fellow American when we learned that the World Trade Centers had been hit, that 3,000 Americans were murdered. We were all working together. I remember Americans standing around the block to give blood, even though we learned later that giving blood really wasn't that necessary because, unfortunately, most of the people who were harmed were killed, not wounded. So it wasn't even necessary, yet Americans from all across the country, not just New York, all across the country were standing in line to give blood. They wanted to help. They wanted to do more. And this was really a great time where a leader, a true leader, who cared more about, I'm sorry to say, more about America than about his own political ends, would have brought the country together, had a big bipartisan ways to help us and secure the homeland. As Bill Clinton said, use that rhetoric of a compassionate conservative, unite the world in a struggle against terror. And instead, well, George Bush used that unity to get more tax cuts and to take us out of world treaties against torture or nuclear test bans. Here we are trying to stop proliferation abroad, nuclear proliferation, Clinton pointed out, and yet we were pulling ourselves out of nuclear test bans. And Clinton pointed out, for the first time ever, we have two huge tax cuts during wartime. And every other time in American history, when we've had a war, when we've had something to fight, the country's raised taxes. We've understood we had to pay for it. George Bush is the first president in American history to decide that he wanted a war, but he didn't want to pay for it. He wanted future generations to pay for it. He wanted our children and grandchildren to pay twice and three times the taxes that they would ordinarily have to pay because the top half of the top 1% didn't want to pay taxes. And I thought Clinton was very good in pointing out that, well, now that he's made money, now that he's doing well, now that he's made millions from his book, he is in the top half of the top 1%. And now the Republicans, who'd always attacked him, well, they cared for him now because he was rich and they made the rest of us pay the bill. And that, you know, these are choices. That these aren't, it's not like the Republicans are out to get the common man, but these are the choices they believe in. They believe that giving huge tax cuts to people making over $1 million a year is more important than educating 2.1 million children so they were left behind. Or job training for 140,000 unemployed, or 100,000 families that need child care, working families. You know, we brought them off of welfare, so are we going to not take care of the children? Are we going to say, look, you know, you can't get the welfare check unless you work, which I support. I support workfare. But you can't get child care either. And if you leave your children at home, well, you're abandoning them. So you either, let's see, you stay home and you don't get your check, or you go to work and you're not making enough because we don't have enough minimum wage, so your children are left behind, and then we charge you with child endangerment. Well, Clinton brought out that these are choices that people are making, that we have rising health care costs, that they're weakening environmental standards, and basically that everyone is sacrificing in America. Our troops are sacrificing, our working poor is sacrificing, everyone is sacrificing in America except the wealthy. And as Bill Clinton pointed out, a lot of the wealthy wanted to help too. I've always said, wealthy people are patriotic too. They also, I think, want to help their country, just as our soldiers and so forth. And then Clinton went on and he talked about the difference between his vision of how to stop crime in America and George Bush's. Listen more to the speech.
The White House this year wants to cut off all the federal funding for 88,000 uniformed police officers under the COP program we've had for 10 years. Among those 88,000 police are more than 700 members of the New York Police Department who put their lives on the line on 9/11. With gang violence rising, and with all of us looking for terrorists in our midst and hoping they're not too well armed or too dangerous, the President and the Congress are about to allow the 10-year-old ban on deadly assault weapons to lapse. Now, they believe it's the right thing to do. But our policy was to put more police on the street and to take assault weapons off the street. And it gave you 8 years of declining crime and 8 years of declining violence. Their policy is the reverse. They're taking police off the streets while they put assault weapons back on the street. Now, if you agree with that choice, by all means, vote to keep them in office. But if you don't, join John Kerry, John Edwards, and the Democrats in making America safer, smarter, and stronger again.
Well, again, Bill Clinton is making clear, you have a choice. You have a choice in this election. If you believe in more cops and less guns on the street, well, then you'll want to vote for John Kerry and John Edwards. If you believe in less cops and more guns, if you believe that everyone has a right to have a machine gun in the streets, well, then, yeah, you'll vote for the Republicans. Again, he's laying out the choice. He's talking about policies. He's not talking about, personal feelings. He's talking about policies. Actually, as I said yesterday, I thought they talked even more about values, and we'll get to that a little bit later. But Clinton is laying out, as a good president, as a good politician, he's laying out the different policies. And I think he did a very good job of it. He also brought up that Homeland Security, of course, is something the Democrats wanted to fund to stop cargo from being unchecked. I've brought out on this show many times something that's striking to me. When they make you take off your shoes in the airport and they look through your bags with a fine-tooth comb, do you know that at the same time underneath the plane are all kinds of bags that aren't being checked by people who aren't even on the flight. I mean, if you're on the flight and you have a bomb, well, at least it kills you, right? If a terrorist brings a bomb on the flight, then he has to be a suicide terrorist, which is certainly possible, and that's why we check. But what about all those that just mail packages? Well, we're not checking those, hardly at all. And the Democrats had a plan to check cargo, to check planes, and so forth. And as Bill Clinton pointed out, it would cost $1 billion. And the Democrats would pay for it by asking 200,000 multimillionaires to give up just $5,000 of the massive tax cuts they received. Just to give you an idea, these tax cuts were at least $100,000. Some made millions in tax cuts. And all they asked is to decrease it by $5,000 so that all of us can be safer. And Bill Clinton pointed out that he thinks a lot of people in his range of income would be willing to pay for that. And then he went on and talked about the deficit. And I want to play more from Bill Clinton's speech.
These policies have turned a projected $5.8 trillion surplus that we left, enough to pay for the baby boomer retirement, into a projected debt of almost $5 trillion. With over $400 billion in deficit this year and for years to come. Now, how do they pay for that deficit? First, by taking the Social Security surplus that comes in every month and endorsing the checks of working people over to me to pay for the tax cut. But it's not enough. So then they have to go borrow money. Most of it they borrow from the Chinese and the Japanese government. Sure, these countries are competing with us for good jobs, but how can we enforce our trade laws against our bankers? I mean, come on. So, if you believe it is good policy to pay for my tax cuts with the Social Security checks of working men and women and borrowed money from China and Japan, you should vote for them. If not, John Kerry's your man.
Well, I think that was one of the best descriptions of the deficit I've heard. And you can't really argue with the truth of it. I mean, there's no question that we're going to have a $5.8 trillion surplus that actually would have saved Social Security. Remember, Clinton was going to devote half the surplus to Social Security. I remember my Republican opponent on Election Tuesdays, Tom Robbins, was complaining that his generation wasn't going to get Social Security. That's true, but not under Bill Clinton. He had it. We had a surplus. That $5.8 trillion surplus went to a $5 trillion debt. That's $10 trillion. Now, let's think about how much money that is. There's 300 million Americans, so that's give or take 30,000 a person, every man, woman, and child. Owes 30,000 bucks, right? Poor family of four owes 120,000 because of one president. It's amazing how much a president can ruin our country in only 4 years. And again, his point is well made. You know, again, Tom Robbins talking last week about Social Security. Those Social Security checks went to the rich. They went to those tax cuts. That's where your Social Security, did you think about it? Every time you pay Social Security, where does that money go? It goes in the pockets of multimillionaires and multibillionaires. They're taking your money, and that's still not enough. We have to borrow from the Chinese and from the Japanese. Well, again, if you want to comment on any of this, just feel free to call in. The number's 877-57-SCOOP. I've got a whole bunch of your emails. I'm going to read them on the break and then read them to you and comment on them right after the break. But you can send an email to comment@radioinsidescoop.com, or you can comment on the blog at www.radioinsidescoop.com, or you're always welcome to call in, 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP. Now, then Clinton goes on and he talks about the war, and he talks about how we fight our enemies. And I think he makes a very good point. Listen close.
We've got to choose for president between two strong men who both love their country, but who have very different world views. Our nominee, John Kerry, who favors shared responsibility, shared opportunity, and more global cooperation. And their president and their party in Congress, who favor concentrated wealth and power, leaving people to fend for themselves and more unilateral action. I think we're right for two reasons. First of all, America just works better when more people have a chance to live their dreams. And secondly, we live in an interdependent world in which we cannot possibly kill, jail, or occupy all our potential adversaries. So we have to both fight terror and build a world with more partners and fewer terrorists.
we can't possibly kill or occupy all of our adversaries. And that's a great point. You know, that seems to be the plan of the Republicans, to kill or occupy all of our adversaries. And we can't do it. And in fact, when we do it, we create more adversaries. You know, it's not static. It's dynamic, to use engineering terms, right? It's not like you have 22,426 members of Al-Qaeda. And if we kill 5,000, then there's only 17,426 members of Al-Qaeda. That ain't how it works, folks. What happens is, if we attack someone who attacked us first, most people in the world understand that. That's why most of the world understood why we went into Afghanistan. But when we attack a country that has never attacked us, suddenly the ranks of terrorists grow. People are upset. Osama bin Laden did not hate American values. He hated American policies, and his followers even more so. He hated our support for all those Arab dictators. And he said that we would occupy any country just to get oil. When we prove him right by invading Iraq, suddenly there's not 22,000 terrorists, there's 220,000 terrorists. Don't you see? And at the same time, we're costing hundreds of billions of dollars and losing American lives. So we cannot kill or occupy every one of our potential adversaries. Instead, we have to do what we've been doing since the World War II, at least, serving as a light unto nations, serving as an example of human rights, so that the world wants to be like us, so they don't want to fight us. And then Clinton goes on to talk about where we are compared to where we were 4 years ago. You know, Ronald Reagan always asked that question, are we better off than we were 4 years ago? Well, Bill Clinton compares his 8 years of his presidency with the last 4 years of George W. Bush. Let's listen.
But the only test that matters, whether people were better off when we finished than when we started, our way works better. It produced over 22 million good jobs, rising incomes for the middle class, over 100 times as many people moved from poverty into the middle class, more health care, the largest increase in college aid in 50 years, record home ownership, a cleaner environment, 3 surpluses in a row, a modernized defense force, strong efforts against terror, and a respected America in the world. It worked better.
That's pretty strong evidence. That's pretty strong evidence. All said in about a minute. That's not easy to do. But, you know, between the jobs and the rising income and people leaving poverty and college age and health care and home ownership and environment and respect for America and the world, that's pretty good, Bill Clinton. And I got to give him credit. I do think he is the best president in my lifetime. And obviously none of that was achieved under George W. Bush. But then Clinton has to go on. He's got to sell the case. He's got to talk about who would replace George Bush. And so he goes on and he talks about a guy by the name of John Kerry. Let's listen.
Now, let me tell you what I know about John Kerry. I've been seeing all the Republican ads about him. Let me tell you what I know about him. During the Vietnam War, many young men, including the current president, the vice president, and me, could have gone to Vietnam and didn't. John Kerry came from a privileged background. He could have avoided going too, but instead, he said, send me. When they sent those swift boats up the river in Vietnam and they told them their job was to draw hostile fire, to wave the American flag and bait the enemy to come out and fight, John Kerry said, send me. And then, on my watch, when it was time to heal the wounds of war and normalize relations with Vietnam and to demand an accounting of the POWs and MIAs we lost there, John Kerry said, send me. Then, when we needed someone to push the cause of inner-city children struggling to avoid a life of crime, or to bring the benefits of high technology to ordinary Americans, or to clean the environment in a way that created new jobs, or to give small businesses a better chance to make it, John Kerry said, send me. So tonight, my friends, I ask you to join me for the next 100 days in telling John Kerry's story and promoting his ideas. Let every person in this hall and like-minded people all across our land say to him what he has always said to America, send me.
Well, I thought that was very powerful, and this is actually the point that Ed, who's hanging on the line, pointed out, Ed from New York, that Clinton pointed out that he himself avoided Vietnam service, as many of the privileged could do. And of course, there's a difference between Clinton's avoiding and Bush and Cheney's. Clinton didn't support the war. Bush and Cheney supported the war, but wanted other people to fight it. But John Kerry, who came back and actually opposed the war, went himself, showed the highest form of sacrifice. And I thought that was a pretty powerful point. I'm glad that Ed from New York picked up on it. And one more thing that you might not have picked up on, and that is send me. Do you know where that comes from? That comes from Isaiah. That is a biblical reference. And Clinton's very good, a very good politician. When he says send me, if you don't know it's a biblical reference, well, you think it's just great rhetoric. But by using those words, send me, talking about a prophet, accepting what God wants the prophet to do, he's really going to the people who do read the Bible every day, do know that passage, and are showing, you know, he's showing respect for their religious beliefs. So I just think that's a great trick for a politician to do. I don't want to make it a trick like it was a bad thing. I think it's a very good thing. It's a way of showing religious people respect at the same time as not forcing religion down someone's throat. Bill Clinton also pointed out that John Kerry was fighting fights for inner city school children, high-tech ordinary Americans, small businesses, environment, and that even in the mid-90s, that when it was hard to be tough on crime or to want work fair instead of welfare or to want balanced budgets, these weren't seen as democratic ideas in the 90s. Clinton supported them, and John Kerry supported Bill Clinton. But Bill Clinton goes on to say something John Kerry has that really sets him apart from our current president, and it's not any particular policy. It's a way of looking at the world, and I think it very well explains the heart of the difference between these two candidates. Here's what John Kerry has that George Bush doesn't have.
And in a time of change, he has two other very important qualities: an insatiable curiosity to understand the world around him, and a willingness to hear other views, even those who disagree with him.
Now think about that, right? An insatiable curiosity to understand the world around him. Now that's obviously, I mean, we all know George Bush says he doesn't even read the newspapers. He doesn't want to know. Here's a guy who never left the United States until he was governor of Texas. He had no curiosity to understand the world around him. And now he wants to, you know, go and invade countries that have never attacked us. So he wants to change the world, a world that he knows nothing about. What's the other difference? John Kerry will listen to people who disagree with him. That is so crucial for a president. No person has a lock on the truth. I think that's one thing that I believe in more strongly than anything else, and I hope all of you believe in. No person has a lock on the truth. I certainly don't. John Kerry doesn't. Certainly George Bush doesn't. Since no person has a lock on the truth, you've got to listen to those that disagree with you. Not necessarily to accept everything they say, but you've got to listen. You've got to hear what they have to say. And a willingness to disagree, a willingness to listen to those who disagree, means that you're going to get better proposals down, right? You're going to hear from people who disagree with you, and you're going to be able to incorporate their ideas and maybe just make your ideas better. And that is a strong character reason to support John Kerry over George W. Bush. And finally, the most powerful words that Bill Clinton said in his whole speech, I'm playing right now.
Their opponents will tell you we should be afraid of John Kerry and John Edwards because they won't stand up to the terrorists. Don't you believe it? Strength and wisdom are not opposing values.
And that is very strong. Now, that's exactly what the Republicans are going to do. That's exactly what they're doing. That's what they did with Al Gore. Do you remember? They're like, oh, well, I'm so glad Al Gore isn't in power now. Why? Why? Do they think Al Gore wouldn't have attacked Al-Qaeda? Far more than Bush had. In fact, I don't think he'd let them go at Bora Bora. They would definitely be... Gore wouldn't have been strong. And Kerry, we know, would have been strong. Kerry is willing to risk his life again and again and again for his country. There's no questioning his strength. But strength and wisdom are not opposing values. You can have strength, and you can have wisdom as well. And so we can have a strong policy, but one that's wise as well. Well, that's it for my discussion of Bill Clinton, but now I want to hear from you. When we go to a break, call in 877-57-SCOOP. I got Ed hanging on. He's going to talk. And then the rest of you, 877-57-SCOOP. Or you can send an email to comment at RadioInsideScoop.com, or you can just comment on the blog at RadioInsideScoop.com. And, you know, I'm going to also come up at the end of the hour. I'm going to talk about the minor players, Ted Kennedy, Howard Dean, Ron Reagan, and then we're going to hear from a person who I think rivals Bill Clinton, and that is the convention speaker, Barack Obama. But in finishing my discussion of Bill Clinton, I just got to hear that song one last time. So we'll go out on Don't Stop Thinking About Tomorrow. But we'll come back right after this song with more of the Inside Scoop and discussions about what you thought about Bill Clinton's speech. So hang on. Call in.
42nd President of the United States, Bill Clinton!
Despicable is not a word that major corporate executives are used to having hurled at them by high elected officials, but the honchos of Diebold Inc. recently got this very word right in their corporate face. The hurler was Kevin Shelley, California's Secretary of State, and he was referring to his experience with Diebold's electronic voting machines in California's March primary elections. Computer glitches plagued that election, jeopardizing its outcome. For example, thousands of San Diego voters were turned away from the polls because Diebold machines malfunctioned. A subsequent investigation by a state panel of experts on electronic voting found that this company, the second largest purveyor of touchscreen voting machines in the country, had violated state law by installing untested and uncertified software in its machines, then lied about it. Their performance, their behavior is despicable, Shelley bluntly said. He also put action behind his words, banning the use of more than 14,000 Diebold machines for this November's election, saying that the machines are not secure and reliable. He also recommended that criminal charges be filed for what he called fraudulent actions by Diebold. Shelley had earlier ruled that by 2006, touchscreen voting machines in California must produce a paper receipt so voters can verify the electoral choices they make on these corruptible computers. But after this year's unpleasantness with Diebold, Shelley says he's now exploring ways to speed up this requirement. This is Jim Hightower saying, meanwhile, in Maryland, a voters group has filed suit to block the use of all 16,000 of Diebold's virtual voting machines in their state unless a paper verification system is installed on each of them. It's all a part of the growing grassroots rebellion to prevent the electronic theft of our elections. To join the fight, go to www.verifiedvoting.org.
It's the stick it where it hurts to feel well patch. Works in a hurry to feel well patch. Lasts a long time to feel well. Well patch, it brings you back to well patch.
Is pain keeping you from feeling well? Try the immediate, long-lasting pain relief of well patch. Well patch comes in a full line of pain-relieving patches that soothes your specific pain. For backache, arthritis, muscle pain, or stiff neck, put on a well patch.
Well patch, it brings you back to well patch.
It's a wild day here at the stock market. Let's talk to some traders. How are you doing?
I'm taking a shelling, but I'm still gelling.
Okay, and how about you?
I'm gelling and selling. Gelling and selling.
My trades are smelling.
Mine too, but who cares?
We're gelling.
Are you gelling yet? Dr. Scholl's massaging gel insoles are made from the softest gel ever created. If you and your feet don't feel outrageously comfortable, you get your money back, guaranteed. Are you gelling? Dr. Scholl's.
Welcome back to Mark Levine's Inside Scoop. Today it's the Inside Scoop on Boston, not just the Inside Scoop on Washington. I've gotten, more than a dozen emails that I'm trying to sort through and read, but I also have a lot of you on the phone. So let's talk about Bill Clinton's part of the speech, and then we'll move on to the other speeches last night. Caller, you're on the air with Mark Levine. What's your first name? Where are you from?
Hey, it's Brian from Jersey. How you doing?
Hey, Brian. What did you think of Bill Clinton's speech?
I thought it was great. It actually it reminded me of this book that I read a while ago by Mark Hertzgaard called The Eagle Shadow.
Okay.
And it just talks about how America, whether we want to believe it or not, we have a huge influence on this world. And it can be taken in an arrogant viewpoint, whereas people can be upset at us because, oh, look at us, we're so great. Or we can turn it around and spread the wealth and share what we have and make ourselves 1,000 times better than we are. I agree with him totally with what he says about terrorism and how John Kerry isn't going to be, you know, I want to say lax on it, but it's very saddening to think that any president would not go after terrorists, and I can't believe that George Bush tries to attack him on that level.
Well, it's ridiculous. I mean, if you look at the vote, okay, after 9/11, you had all 100 senators and 434 out of 435 members of Congress vote to go after Osama bin Laden. There was no American that I know of. I'm sure there's some out there. I don't want to say that. So there's some out there. But let's say 99% of America supported fighting back against al-Qaeda. The difference is that not all of us supported fighting Iraq, which had nothing to do with the attack. And so it's amazing. The Republicans are saying this, but are they convincing anyone? I mean, is anyone in the middle believing? Maybe there are some people who believe that John Kerry wouldn't fight back. But then again, he went in Vietnam and fought while George Bush was AWOL. So I think it's a very weak argument for them to make, but yeah, they keep making it.
Well, the problem is that, it always comes back to this, and it seems like us in the liberal media are complaining about it, but it is the big corporate media that's not bringing up these issues to let the middle class that doesn't have the time to read everything, doesn't have the time, they just have the time to come home, watch the news for an hour, and boom, that's the reality. But unfortunately, they're not getting the full picture, and if they were, I don't think they would have any thought in their mind that John Kerry wasn't going to be tough on terrorism.
Well, I hope that Americans are watching the convention, and probably they're not. They didn't watch last night, which is too bad because they missed a fantastic speech by Barack Obama that hopefully we'll have time to play today. If not, we'll play tomorrow. But it was really incredible to hear the things they were saying. And again, it wasn't attacks on Bush. It was attacks for American values, for democratic values. It was very powerful.
Well, when you run a smear campaign against a candidate's personality over their issues, you know that you have nothing to fight against, and that's exactly what George Bush is doing, and I think Kerry understands that he doesn't need to do that.
I think it's a great point. Thanks for calling in,
Thanks,
Brian.
Mark.
I appreciate it. Caller, you're on the air with Mark Levine. What's your comment or question?
Hi, yeah, this is Gordon. Hi, I have disagreed with Bill Clinton in the past, but I have to lay a rose upon the altar today and give him kudos.
Did you hear the speech when he delivered it live?
Yeah, and I liked the way you highlighted what he had to say. He gave the big picture. He gave what I believe in, and many people in this country realize that there's a choice looming over this election that is very, very important. And I just have to say that he transcended all of the arguments I've had against him by making that speech. I think he took a shot from Jon Stewart, though.
Okay.
You heard that.
Tell me, what did he take from Jon Stewart?
It had something to do with the last two words that you had said. It was to do with wisdom versus what?
Strength.
Yeah, but and then Stewart said something about, is that the... How you he tried to make a difference between power and self-control, which he tried to allude to Clinton, but it fell really short.
Yeah.
Because of the power of what Clinton had said.
Yeah, well, I think it was a very powerful speech. And I'll tell you, when I see Bill Clinton, I get so nostalgic because that was a time I didn't agree with everything Bill Clinton did, and certainly he wasn't a perfect president or a perfect human being, but I felt like we had a guy in the White House who cared, who actually cared. I felt like, when they used to joke, the Republicans, that Clinton felt your pain. But he really did. Clinton was a guy who could see the pain of a family trying to make enough to pay for health care for their dying son or to get their daughter to go to college. He really did feel their pain. He did care about every one of us. And I just, there's something about knowing that there's someone in charge who actually cares that, I don't know, made it a lot easier to sleep at night. And so I guess, and maybe I've overplayed the song, but every time I hear Don't Stop Thinking About Tomorrow, it just brings back in me those feelings of the 90s when we had a president who, as imperfect as he was, I knew that he cared, he was watching, he was smart, he
I think you're hitting it. You're talking about a basic goodness that I think the whole country hungers for.
Yeah, and hopefully we'll get again. Thanks again for your call, Gordon.
Yep.
I appreciate that. I tell you, I want to go and I want to read some of the many emails that I've gotten and respond to them. And I want to talk about, oh, there's so much to talk about. I'll tell you, though, there's no rush. There's no rush. We have today, tomorrow, Friday. We can go into next week. Instead of rushing through and just giving sound bites, all right, let's talk about who these people are, what their speeches were. And let me respond to some of the emails that I've been getting on all kinds of issues dealing with the Democratic National Convention. For example, I got an email here from Fred who wants to know about the free speech zones outside the convention. Who asked for them? The Democratic Party, the City of Boston, someone else? That's a great question, Fred. I don't know who asked for them. I suspect it was the City of Boston, but I really don't know, and I got to tell you, I'm not a fan of them. I myself, actually, in 1996, went down to San Diego, California, to protest at the Republican National Convention. Some people have heard me tell this story. And I had my Clinton-Gore sign and was taunting the delegates, taunting them, of course, verbally, never physically. And they threatened to arrest me because I was outside the free speech zone, which was half a mile away, and no one could see anyone there. I think that you need to have a place where people can protest. I understand how you separate people. For example, when you have a rally for anything, it could be a Klan rally, and you have the people who oppose the Klan rally, and you have them in a separate place. I understand why the police separate the groups. But if you're going to have a zone where you want to express yourself, it's got to be a place where the delegates can see. And so I got to say that I think, whether Democrat or Republican, doesn't matter, that the delegates should have to go past the free speech zone in order to enter the hall. They should have to, and you know, the police can check and make sure there are no weapons or anything. I have no problem with that. But free speech should definitely not be out of sight, out of mind. So I don't know who asked for it, but I'm not a big fan of those things in either place. Got another email that asks, if Kerry's elected, can he, through executive order, ban the tax cuts to the wealthy and use those to pay for war or homeland security? Actually, no. He's got to pass a law through Congress, which is why it's important to elect Democrats to the House and the Senate and not just elect John Kerry. He can't do it by executive order. You just can't do that. The Constitution says you have to have a bill, and that's the way to do it. I want to talk briefly about the three minor speeches, and we may have to save my favorite speaker last night till tomorrow, but that's okay. Like I said, we'll have all week to talk about it. We can go into next week. I do want to give Obama Barack, who was incredible, I want to give him his fair due. So we may have to move him to tomorrow. There were three minor speeches that we heard last night. Ted Kennedy, Howard Dean, and Ron Reagan, the son of President Reagan. Ted Kennedy, I actually think, was the weakest speech. I think he's getting up there in age. It was a good speech. Don't get me wrong. I just think, compared to the others, it wasn't as strong as Teresa Hines Carey or Barack Obama. He was kind of hoarse. He was the only president, the only speaker, I should say, to mention George Bush and Dick Cheney by name. None of the other ones did. And he talked about the unequal system we have, where it's the quality of your connections rather than what you do for a living. And he talked about the history. He gave us actually a good history lesson about Boston, the Democratic Party as the party of Social Security and Medicare and student aid. And he talked about how, well, Vice President Cheney cares much more about Enron and Halliburton, and he hopes, in fact, that Vice President Cheney will return soon to an undisclosed location, how the Republicans are seeking to divide us. And I think that's been a common theme taken up by many, and really the main theme of the convention, that the Republicans are always seeking to divide us rather than unite us. And how ironic from the president, who claimed to be a uniter, not a divider. It was interesting when we saw the speech to see Maria Shriver in the audience. his niece, who is the wife of Arnold Schwarzenegger. She's going to be at both conventions, honored. And what I guess what struck me is thinking that Arnold Schwarzenegger's ideas, while certainly not totally Democratic ideas, are far closer to the Democratic Party than those of the Republican Party. It's interesting, we'll talk about the Republican convention when we get there, but the Republicans are going to show all these people who support women's rights to choice, who support gay rights, who support civil rights, who support government staying out of our personal lives, not trying to control us through religion, the way the Republicans in Congress certainly do, the way the president certainly believes that the government needs to be involved intimately, telling us who to pray for, all those things, faith-based initiative. Well, the Republican speakers, Arnold Schwarzenegger, Rudolph Giuliani, George Pataki, none of them believe in those Republican principles. And so it's very interesting. It'll be very interesting when they have their sham convention. Let me play for you, though, what I do think was the best of Ted Kennedy's speech, and I'm going to play that right now.
Our struggle is not with some monarch named George who inherited the crown, although it often seems that way. Our struggle is with the politics of fear and favoritism in our own time, in our own country. Our struggle, like so many others before, is with those who put their own narrow interest ahead of the public interest. We hear echoes of past battles in the quiet whisper of the sweetheart deal, in the hushed promise of a better break for the better connected. We hear them in the cries of the false patriots who bully dissenters into silence and submission.
Well, I think that says it pretty clearly. I've often talked about Prince George. I'm glad to see that theme's being carried on with George the monarch. But it's not just a reference to the revolution. It's a reference to this sort of sense of entitlement that George Bush gets whatever he wants and always has. As a kid and every which way. And it's, again, the politics of putting narrow interest, the people who favor the corporations and so forth, who favor George Bush, ahead of the public interest. And I thought he made that point very well. And, again, talking about the right and freedom of dissent. You're going to hear these themes throughout the Democratic Convention. All these things that I've been saying on air, it's nice to hear back. It's nice to hear that validation that the right of dissent, there's nothing more important in America than the right of dissent. But overall, it wasn't one of the stronger speeches, and I want to move on. Let's talk quickly about Howard Dean's speech. Howard Dean, of course, was the front runner in the Democratic nomination for a long while. Many thought he was going to win it, and he used his signature lines that are very good, very powerful, take this country back. He used Paul Wellstone's own line, with a Democratic wing of the Democratic Party. The president has to tell the truth to the American people before sending soldiers off to war, a very powerful point, a very important point. Again, another theme we're going to hear many times. And I thought that Howard Dean was particularly good in giving individual stories of people. We're going to hear that later from Barack Obama. He got a very warm reception. He was very calm, no scream. He seemed almost, in fact, a little too calm, I thought. And I thought he just put it simply, I'm Howard Dean, and I'm voting for John Kerry, letting people know, letting his supporters know, those that might consider voting for that Republican tool, Ralph Nader, that John Kerry is the right guy to speak for him and the right person to support. That clearly, whatever you felt about Howard Dean, even if you voted for him, even if you loved Howard Dean, clearly John Kerry is preferable to George Bush or George Bush's Republican tool, Ralph Nader. Here I thought was Howard Dean's best part of the speech, the part about how we shouldn't be afraid to be Democrats.
We are not going to be afraid to stand up for what we believe in ever again. We are not going to let those who disagree with us shout us down under a banner of false patriotism. We are not going to give up a single voter or a single state because we're going to be proud to call ourselves Democrats. Not just here in Boston. We're going to be proud to call ourselves Democrats in Mississippi. We're going to be proud to call ourselves Democrats in Utah and Idaho. And we are going to be proud to call ourselves Democrats in Texas.
And that's indeed what Howard Dean brought back to the Democratic Party. that we shouldn't be afraid of calling ourselves Democrats anywhere in the country. We have powerful values to stand up for that we believe in, and take it even to Texas. And I thought, it was a good speech, but I think Kennedy's and Dean's speeches were actually probably the two weakest of last night. I do want to move on and talk about one other short speech, and that's Ron Reagan's. No, I'm not neglecting the two powerhouses of last night. Barack Obama, and Teresa Hines Carrier, I thought, delivered incredible speeches, particularly from Barack Obama. We're going to talk about all of that in detail tomorrow, along with John Edwards' speech. And then, of course, Friday we'll deal with John Kerry's speech. But let's talk about Ron Reagan. It's interesting. I've gotten more comments on the blog about Ron Reagan than anyone else. Ron Reagan, of course, is the son of late President Ronald Reagan. He is the only son, I believe, the only child of Ronald Reagan and Nancy Reagan. The others were children of Ronald Reagan's first wife, Jane Wyman. And he came to speak about stem cell research, and to talk about why we need stem cell research. Of course, as most of you know, George Bush has said he's going to have very limited stem cell research because he doesn't want to use any embryos. And that's basically the argument of the anti-abortion crowd, the pro-life crowd. And it's very interesting that, of course, a Republican son, you know, the son of the greatest Republican president, the one that the Republicans want to put on our money and on our buildings, would speak at a Democratic National Convention. What's even more interesting is that Nancy Reagan, his mother, Ronald Reagan's wife, refuses to speak at the Republican convention. She doesn't speak at the Democratic one, and that would be seen as a real apostasy, I guess. But she won't speak at the Republican convention either, and I think that's because she's very angry by the failure of the Republicans to accept stem cell research, something that might have helped her husband, who had Alzheimer's disease. And Ron Reagan, I thought, very well pointed out that the theology of a few should not stop the health of many. And he talked about the people that are really suffering with these diseases, and why is it that we're saving this cell instead of these real people with real diseases. I actually thought Ron Reagan made one of the best arguments I've ever heard for my position on abortion, which is a pro-choice position, talking about the difference between one cell after conception and a real live human being. Let's listen to Ron Reagan.
It is a hallmark of human intelligence that we are able to make distinctions. Yes, these cells could theoretically have the potential under very different circumstances to develop into human beings. That potential is where their magic lies. But they are not, in and of themselves, human beings. They have no fingers and toes, no brain or spinal cord. They have no thoughts, no fears. They feel no pain. Surely, we can distinguish between these undifferentiated cells multiplying in a tissue culture and a living, breathing person, a parent, a spouse, a child.
Well, that puts it really well, right? Surely we can distinguish between these cells and a living, breathing human being. This is the same argument I've often made in the abortion context. Surely it matters more, a living, breathing woman, right? Her life, her values, she's been around, she has thoughts and fears and pain. There's no question of her humanity. And some cells that maybe one day could develop life, but you know, won't unless they're given a mother to live in, right? Frankly, if you're talking about potential life, I've never understood why people aren't trying to protect every sperm and egg out there. I guess there's too many millions. But I thought Ron Reagan really put it nicely, the difference and the value of using these cells to save human beings rather than potential lives. I do want to read from some of the many, many emails that I've gotten, and then please tune in tomorrow. We didn't get to Barack Obama's speech, but it was incredible. And you really should hear the whole speech by going to www.cspan.org. But still listen to my show tomorrow, because we're going to be playing the best parts of the speech, and then I really want to comment on why I think it was so effective. Let me read some of the comments on the blog just as we go out in the last 3 minutes. I got a comment from Bert in Kansas. He says, he wrote this last night, he wrote, two words, Barack Obama, thank you, good night. I couldn't agree with you more, Bert. I have to tell you, I haven't decided yet who I'm voting for in the Democratic primary of 2012. I'm going to vote, obviously, to reelect John Kerry in 2008. And certainly Hillary Clinton and John Edwards are good candidates. But right now, in the 2012 primary, I'm leaning toward Barack Obama. And we're going to play a lot of what he had to say tomorrow. I do want to read from some more of the emails that I've gotten here. We've got a lot of comments on Ron Reagan, talking about him and his, you know, apostasy, if you will. We also have, okay, so here's a comment from Rick. I've never seen Ron Reagan speak until now. He's a very good speaker. His half-brother, Mike Reagan, was ripping on him and Patty this morning. It sounds like Mike was doing damage control for the Republicans. I didn't catch much of the other speeches, but here Obama rocked. How did Dean do? Well, I think I've answered your question. Dean did okay, but not great. And if for a link where the speeches can be heard, again, go to cspan.org. Another comment says, I didn't hear Mike Reagan, but I heard him on Hannity. He wasn't ripping on Ron and Patty as much as stressing disagreements. As I'm sure you know, Patty and Ron are hardcore liberals, and Mike is a conservative. His main point was that Ron isn't as educated as she should be on stem cell research. Comment from Rick. Clinton's speech rocked. I was ready to elect him president again. A comment from Juniper. Bill Clinton says they want a divided country. So true. Another comment from Juniper. I think this convention is doing an amazing job of showing us just how incompetent the current administration has proven to be. It seems like the only way for the right to avoid the shame of the mistakes made in the last 4 years is to not talk about any issues, but rather ask us about how exciting is Kerry. Another comment by Rick, who's comparing Ron and Mike Reagan, but saying basically that Mike Reagan is just pushing the right's propaganda, basically the religious right isn't respecting science. They're not looking to see what science is. There's a lot of other comments on the blog. We didn't get to them all today. We don't have much time. Again, if you want to hear the speeches in full, by all means, tune in to cspan.org. But I hope you'll tune in tomorrow. I want to read some more of your comments. We've got a lot to talk about. And then I really want to get into Barack Obama's speech. I want to get into Theresa Hines Carey's speech, which I thought was very powerful, very gentle, very different from the other speeches. It was very sweet, actually. Not actually the speech I expected to hear. It was both sweet and strong. I'm going to read some more of your comments. And then we move on to John Edwards. And then coming up Friday, we talk about John Kerry. But you know what? There's no limit on time here. If we have to go